Public Affairs, Mr. Warden.
And good afternoon, committee. Thank you for your prompts, duly noted. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 16A. With that said, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown, and I appreciate you giving Senate Bill 16A a hearing for, did I say it for the record? I can't remember.
Yes, okay, all right.
Senate Bill 16A establishes Sister State Committee to promote Oregon's sister state relationships. The committees will host visiting delegations and organize delegations from Oregon to visit our sister states. I can say from personal experience that these delegations do improve relationships and further enhance trade opportunities with Oregon's trading partners. Last year, as a member of the Friendship and Trade Mission to China, I had the great opportunity to witness firsthand the value of these contacts. Along with delegates representing Oregon's small and medium-sized businesses, I saw the need in China for many services and products in which Oregon specializes, one which I believe was smoked oysters from Representative Berger's territory, and they were to die for. In addition to the smoked oysters, there was grass seed for pasture land, water treatment facilities, and air quality controls in China's urban areas. I'm not sure that smoked oysters fall into that category. After my visit to China, I was very confident that the contacts we made will result in expanded trade between Oregon and China, and Oregon currently ranks about 25th among U.S. states that trade with China, even though we are one of their closest U.S. neighbors. China's fastest-growing markets are high technology, wood and paper products, and environmentally sustainable services and products, all things that are Oregon's largest exports. These delegations of Oregon business and government officials do have an impact on our foreign counterparts and provide opportunities that may not have been available prior to. I again urge passage of Senate Bill 16A as a very inexpensive method to promote Oregon businesses and enhance the state's trade economy. And I would be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Senator Brown, I have a question. Are sister states different from sister cities? We have a sister city between Coos Bay, Oregon, and Choshi, Japan, but those exchanges are not allowed for any business purposes. So there must be quite a difference in being a sister state.
Could we have Senator Yee join the witness table, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, and Senator Yee may be better ready to answer that question than am I, because I do, but I do know that Portland has sister city relationships. I know that we visited Suzhou, which is Portland's sister city. So we do have those relationships. I don't know specifically how they differ. Senator Yee, do you?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Verger, sister state is a sister relationship between a state and a province, for example, in China. It's not a city to city. It's state to state. And in China, state is a province. Mm-hmm. And I have prepared amendment to explain sister state means international state.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, please. I believe that would be the distinction there. The sister city relationships are twofold, but when you have exchanges that are between sister cities, that's with students that promote fellowship, there's no business. Then if you're going to do a business, it's a different kind of thing. So I think the state would just simply be different. I just wanted to clarify that in my own mind. Mm-hmm. All right.
Where does the money come from to finance the trip?
Mr. Chairman, it's self-funded. Everybody pays their own expenses.
And Mr. Chair, let me give you a specific example. Last May, when I joined the China delegation, we have some legislative travel funds, of which I used a portion of those in order to fund the trip. Other members, legislative members, used their own personal dollars, and other members who went along on the trip, business delegates, they paid their own way. My husband, for example, paid his own way.
Thank you. On the dash A5 amendments, can we talk just a little bit about the staffing so that we're fully clear about that?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I have provided staff dash 5 amendment, and this amendment basically limits the legislative committee meetings to 2, one before the trip and one after the trip, so that the fiscal impact is very limited. I understand the fiscal impact is about $1,500, so it's very minimal.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll head out and let Senator Yee testify.
Thank you.
Senator Yee. Could I ask Mr. Steve Greenwood to come up with me? And he is part of the delegation who went. He is a regional director of Department of Environmental Quality. He went with us and helped us a great deal in better understanding of environmental issues in China. Should I go ahead with my testimony? I have prepared testimony, and I have with me 12 copies. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator Mei Yi, representing Senate District 19, which consists of portions of Lynn and Benton counties. Senate Bill 16 comes to you from the Senate with unanimous support. It establishes a sister state committee to promote sister state relationships. The committee will host visiting delegations and organize delegations from Oregon to visit our sister states, creating a better understanding of other cultures and improve trade relationships. Last May, former Senate President Brady Adams led a successful friendship and trade delegation to China, which included 5 legislators as well as a number of trade delegates representing small and medium-sized businesses such as the grass seed, food processing, forestry engineering, forestry nursery, agricultural machinery and equipment, environmental protection and recycling industries. Although it was a 2-week trip, the visit produced many positive results and new relationships. The mayor of Shanghai, Mayor Su, for instance, is anxious to start a working relationship with Oregon to explore the air quality and urban planning model that Portland Metro is currently developing. An 8-member delegation just visited Oregon last week from Shanghai for this purpose, which Mr. Greenwood very ably helped organize the visit. Legislative trade missions are important. When high-level officials visit, doors are open that normally would not be. Just recently, one of the trade delegates who went with us to China announced that because he made such good contacts during the trip and sees enough of a potential market for his products, that he is opening a trade office in Beijing. In Shanghai and Fujian province, we presented scholarships for 2 graduate students to come and study in our universities in environmental sciences. They are here since last month for 2 years of graduate studies. Oregon is a leader in high-tech agricultural forest products and environmental protection industries. We should capitalize on opportunities to expand our reach all over the world. Sister-city relationship do this. This bill has a very minimal fiscal impact, but its impact on potential growth is major. I'm submitting here with Amendment 5, which limits administrative support to no more than 2 meetings of the sister state committee, possibly 1 before and 1 after the trip. The other provision of the amendment defines sister state as an international state. I urge your adoption of the dash 5 amendment and adoption of the amended A and Grow Senate Bill 16 to the floor with a dual pass recommendation. I would like to introduce Mr. Steve Greenwood from the Department of Environmental Quality, and he's a delegation member.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Steve Greenwood. I work with the Department of Environmental Quality. Excuse me. I'm here in part in that role, but also because I have participated on the China Trade and Friendship Task Force that has been operating during the interim. I was very fortunate enough to be a member of the delegation that went to China last spring. I presented the principal paper at a seminar on sustainable development that the Chinese gave to us or held in Shanghai, China. And as Senator Yi just said, I had also the good fortune to be involved in the planning of a technical exchange visit here in Oregon from eight Chinese officials, again from the city of Shanghai. I can't speak to the technicalities of the bill. What I can say is this, that before I made that visit last spring, I probably wouldn't have put something like this high on my priority list. Because of the visit and because of the contact I've had, my perspective on this has changed pretty radically, and I began to understand and realize that you have a country of over a billion people that is growing at an incredibly rapid pace economically, so that there is tremendous potential in terms of, I think, in this century, trade and other cultural exchange opportunities between Oregon and China. We happen to be, by geography, well-placed, I think, sharing an ocean with China and having a major port here, actually several major ports here in the state of Oregon. So I think that there are tremendous opportunities for the future in terms of the economic benefits. But I also would say that one of the great gains that I and I think other members of the delegation had was simply an understanding that we share a lot more than an ocean, that there are a lot of things that we have in common as human beings, not the least of which is environmental issues to deal with, and simply the understanding between the peoples of their country and our country, I think, is exceedingly important, and I think that that's been underscored in recent weeks, that kind of communication and understanding is vitally important for everyone's long-term future. So I'm here to speak for the bill for those reasons.
Thank you. I've got a question. We've got, do I see here, we have relationships with four sister states currently. And these committees are, it is assumed that these committees will visit or exchange visits, as I read this, once a biennium. So that could conceivably mean up to four trips and four sets of meetings in a biennium. And I'm just wondering about the cost of $1,500 listed here. Is that the anticipated cost of one meeting, one series of two meetings, or four series of two meetings?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to call your attention to Senate Bill 16 on page 1, line 4. It's under Section 1, Sub 1. It says, upon the request of any legislator for a sister state relationship in which the state participates, a sister state committee. A legislator has to ask for the committee to be formed. So if the other three sister state relationship, if no legislator requested, then a committee does not need to be formed. This committee is only formed upon the request of a legislator.
Representative Devlin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Yi, the normal process for this in terms of what you're talking about in terms of administrative costs is the cost for the committee. Normally, these trips, the cost have been borne by the individual members, haven't they?
Yes.
The actual cost of travel.
Yes. The cost is borne by each individual. And legislators allow $1,400 for out-of-state trips. So some legislators may use this expense if they want to use it for their out-of-state expenses, up to $1,400. But then they can use it for other trips to out-of-state functions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Yee, but our only expenditure here is just the administrative cost of managing the committee or providing resources to the committee.
Yes. And the organization is done by one of the trade delegates that is appointed by the leadership.
I guess what I'm getting at is if we already have four state relationships, and it is assumed, and I may be wrong here, it's assumed that if requested, there could be up to four visits every biennium by these groups, then in reality you could have to fund that committee up to essentially four times $1,500 for committee support. And that could happen.
Yes, it could have, but it's not anticipated, Mr. Chairman, that there will be other committees requested.
Okay. Further questions? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could I just want to thank Senator Yee. One of the senators from my district, Senator Messerly, went on your trip, and
yes.
I want you to know that he had a wonderful report back to our community. And in that report was your graciousness and your work in organizing it and how well it went because of you. And I want to pass that on to you.
Oh, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Any further questions? All right. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16, and I'd open a work session on Senate Bill 16. Representative Devlin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 16A.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves the dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 16A. Do we have any discussion? Any objections? So not.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
Move Senate Bill 16A as amended to the floor. Okay. Move Senate Bill 16A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Can I do both these both?
Mm-hmm.
And move to rescind subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves Senate Bill 16A as amended to the floor with due pass and rescind subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Right.
We're rescinding it.
We're rescinding it. Okay. Any discussion? Jennifer, call the roll, please. Representative Berger, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 16. Okay, and as long as Senator Yee is here, let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 825. Senator Yee.
Thank you. Could I ask Mr. Hassel Henry to come up with me? He's the one who requested the bill.
Okay.
He's editor of Albany Democrat Herald.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, consisting of portions of Linn and Benton counties. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Senate Bill 825 comes to you from the Senate with 29 aye votes. It proposes that ballot measures be numbered consecutively without an upper limit. Historically, ballot measures each election year with numbers starting with one. In the early 1990s, several controversial ballot measures ended up having the same number. Measure 5 is a good example of the problem. In 1990, Measure 5 limited property taxes. 2 years later, there was another Measure 5 that would have closed the Trojan nuclear plant. In 1993, at the request of the editor of Albany Democrat Herald, Mr. Hassel Herring, I proposed that ballot measures be numbered consecutively in order to avoid confusion among the electorate. The Secretary of State's office and the legislature agree. Starting with the special election in the fall of 1993, our ballot measures had different numbers. However, the change did not go far enough. As the law currently reads, when the number of measures reaches 99, the numbering sequence shall recommence with the number 1. This past fall, we ran out of original numbers. The ballot measures number from 83 through 99, and then we had 9 more. This meant that voters were asked to decide on Measure 5 again. This time, Measure 5 mandated background checks by private sellers at gun shows. Unless the headline gives a clue, readers would not have an immediate idea whether Measure 5 is about taxes or guns. It is time to complete the job we started in 1993 and change the system so ballot measures are numbered consecutively without an upper limit. Giving every measure its own number will help prevent confusion and promote clarity. The state of Washington has no upper limit, and their system is working well. This proposal is again recommended by Mr. Herring from the Albany Democrat Herald. I urge your support of Senate Bill 825, and at this time, I would like to present Mr. Herring.
Welcome, Mr. Herring.
Thank you. I'm Hassel Herring, and I am the editor of the Democrat Herald in Albany. You have already heard all the marvelous arguments in favor of this bill from Senator Yee. There's only one more thing that I might add, and that is that the system that we propose might have an unanticipated benefit in the sense of giving voters and the public in general an idea of how far we go with this initiative system, with the system of having ballot measures. When you get to the point in a few years of ballot measure 892, you will have a the public will have a reminder either of the flourishing participatory democracy that we have here in Oregon, or they might get the idea that we have gone a bit too far. But in any case, it might have some sort of an educational aspect to it. I feel honor-bound to tell you that when I appeared on this bill before the Senate committee that considered it, I did not quite know what California had done, and I gave the impression that California had a system similar to what we're proposing here. As it turns out, California did have a system like that. We're all familiar with some of those measures that have three digits that were controversial and much in the news from California. But it turns out that because of a conflict because of a perceived confusion with positions on the ballot, California has rescinded that system and has gone to a system where they renumber everything every couple of years. We don't have that problem anymore in Oregon, at least we shortly will not, as I understand it, because we get away from the ballot position problem, which is associated with punch card ballots mostly. When you have paper ballots, you don't have to worry about trying to transfer the ballot number from the ballot to the punch card and trying to get the right one. So I anticipate that would not be much of a problem. Essentially, we're asking for this bill in order to facilitate or to make simple the political shorthand in the state, so that when we're talking about ballot measure 5, particularly as mentioned by Senator Yee, or ballot measure 9 or some of the other controversial ones that we've had, that we know what we're talking about. and anticipating, you know, many years down the road that they'll have some that will be famous and controversial and that we'll know exactly what they are by just referring to the number. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have questions. Representative Devlin.
Yeah. Senator Yee, when you were involved in the legislation in 93, did you anticipate that it would only take, well, in the fourth election cycle, we made it through the entire list of numbers?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Devlin, I didn't anticipate we get to 99 so soon.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is an excellent bill, an easy change when it's only statutory that we can do three.
Mm-hmm. Hey, for the discussion, questions, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herring, there are kind of two questions. One is, how about if when we got to 999, we rolled over? And the second is, since you're trying to, your one concept of getting the idea of how many initiatives and such the voters have voted on, should we go back, add up all the initiatives that we've done over the last 100 years, and start there?
Yeah, so you're sick. Well, you're, in my opinion, I think the second, you don't need to go that far, I wouldn't think. I think the idea here is to eliminate or to prevent confusion, and I think maybe if you did what you're suggesting, that would just cause all kinds of confusion. It would be sort of a form of historical revisionism that we're trying to avoid, I guess. As to your other question, which was what again?
In other words, when we get to 1,000,
when you get to 999, which we hope will not be in our lifetime, I guess.
My calculation is 72 years.
You know, yeah.
But, it might be in yours, but not.
You might, I mean, the legislature in that year might consider a change, I would guess. But on the other hand, it might not. For all I know, I mean, I don't think that is something that we worry about too much.
Representative Gerard.
Mr. Herring, Senator Yee, I would just like to thank you for bringing this legislation forward, because I think it's a great move to help clarify the general public what is badly needed. So I thank you for bringing this and seeing it through.
Thank you.
Any further from this side? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 825, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 825. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 825 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Devlin moves Senate Bill 825 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion on the measure?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wanted the committee to know that despite my rabid environmentalism and deep desire to reuse lawn signs, I'll support this measure tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Further discussion? None. Jennifer, would you call the roll? Representative Devlin has expressed interest in carrying that bill. Work session is closed on Senate Bill 825. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 777. And I think Richard Burke.
Keep adding.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Burke. I currently work as a legislative assistant for Senator Gary George, and he permitted me to submit this bill, and it currently comes before you after having passed the Senate by a vote of 23-3. Here's what it does. As you can see in the handout that's being distributed to you, the objective of Senate Bill 777 is to allow well-established minor political parties to forego running candidates for public office with the sole objective of winning the 1% vote required to maintain ballot access. Current minor party law says that to maintain your status as a minor party, you must win 1% of the vote in a partisan election for that electoral district in which you have status. And the rationale behind this law is that to maintain your ballot status, you should be able to show that you have some significant backing to justify your status. And I think that that makes a lot of sense. But some parties, like the Pacific Green Party and the Libertarian Party, have thousands and thousands of registered voters. Libertarians have 14,000. Pacific Greens have like 9,700 voters. And these, being able to register that many people shows that you do have some significant level of backing. But the law that says we have to get 1% forces us, and I want to underscore that, forces us to run candidates for office whether we want to or not. This is bad for everyone. It's bad for major political parties because it increases the number of potential spoilers in races because you're forced to run. I was the 1998 candidate for governor from the Libertarian Party, and I can tell you that was a major reason why I ran. Everybody was saying, well, who can we run to get our 1%, you know, where we might not have run myself or may not have run any candidate at all. In the last election, we ran 3 statewide candidates instead of 1 for that very reason. So the current system isn't good for major parties. It's not very good for minor parties either that are well established, because we do better if we can concentrate our people and our resources on local nonpartisan elections. Right after I ran for governor, I was elected to the Tualatin Valley Water District Board of Commissioners. And there, you know, you don't have to worry about party labels. You just put out ideas and try to do good work for the community. And so what this bill basically says is that if you've registered 0.5% of the electorate, you've done your job. You've shown that you have some basic support worthy of justifying your status, and you don't have to run spoiler candidates. You know, and you only need to run candidates if you really want to and they really think they have a chance to win and they really want to try hard. And I've run this bill past Scott Tye of the Secretary of State's office, and he said that there's no problem implementing this bill. And if you'll look at the sponsor list, you'll see that there are prominent Republicans and Democrats on both sides that think that this is a great bill. And it passed 23-3. I asked one of the opponents why he voted against it, and he said, well, I had a bad experience with minor parties. I vote no on anything having to do with minor parties. If I had read the bill, I'd probably have voted the other way. So, I mean, so there really isn't a hardcore opposition to this, and so I respectfully urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Burke.
Yes, sir.
I'm curious, what was the original intent of the present law of requiring the 1% at every general election?
I was involved with that. That law was changed, I believe, in 93. And the original intent of that is that if you're going to have minor party status, you need to be able to show that you have some minimal amount of backing in order to justify your ballot access. You know, you're thinking if you're going to be a minor party with ballot access, you need to have some minimal backing. And the 1% showed that you have backing. The premise of this bill is that if you're able to register 0.5%, which statewide amounts to about 10,000 voters, then you've done that. You've shown that you've got at least 10,000 people who are registered to your party, and you've shown some semblance of support.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. So the list of registered voters was not required under the current law, only the 1% in the general, or were both still required?
There was a combination. You had to do both. You had to maintain your party status. You had to get 1% in every general election, plus you needed to register some very, very small number. Like, I think it's like 0.01% or it's down here. But it's very, very small. But you had to do both, okay? And so, in essence, the number is so small that nobody worries about it. None of the minor parties worry about that number. The issue is running someone for office every time and being forced to run and forced to get that 1%. Now, for parties that aren't established, that's the only way you can show support. But for parties that have registered 0.5% you've established, you've got some staying power, you've got some backing, and I'm contending that such parties shouldn't be forced to run candidates if they don't want to, because parties like to be selective, like to maybe run here, not run there, put our best people in local candidates or in issue campaigns, and current law just forces us to waste money and introduce an increased number of spoiler candidates into partisan races.
Thank you. Representative Gardner?
Yeah, just one quick curiosity question. You put an awful lot of qualifiers on, your run for governor. You might not, possibly wouldn't have run. You were a candidate. If this requirement wasn't there, would you have run?
No.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the reason why I put qualifiers on that, Representative Gardner, is because this wouldn't stop minor parties from running candidates. If you have someone who's got an issue they really want to push and they think a campaign is how to do it, well, sure, they can still run. But I can tell you at conventions, we sit around saying, okay, we've got to get our 1%. In the last election cycle, Mitch Schultz was our candidate for state treasurer, and he was going to run no matter what because this is something he believed in and he wanted to do. But what if Mitch Schultz gets hit by a bus? Or what if his intel transfers him out of state? If that's our only candidate, we lose our status. So you've got to run for everything you can. So while we would have run Mitch Schultz no matter what, we would not have run Tom Cox for Attorney General. We would not have run Ed Pohl for Secretary of State.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're not interested in running candidates, statewide, I mean, 1% is a pretty small number, and you've got at least three statewide, or two, at least two statewide partisan races each time. And what's the purpose for being your minor party?
Well, it's not that we're not, Representative March, Mr. Chairman, it's not that we're not interested in running campaigns. And you have to remember our candidate, our pool of candidates is a lot smaller than those of the major parties.
Well,
it's a question of where we run is where we apply our best candidates. I'm not saying we won't run. We'll be running candidates who really want to say something. We'll be running candidates who really have something to offer the people of Oregon. We will no longer run candidates who agree to throw their name up just to get the 1%, okay? Because what will happen is Mitch Schultz is a candidate who would want to run. That person would answer your concern. Why run? And that's an example of someone who would run, okay? But why do we run Cox and why do we run Pohl? Because if something happens to Mitch Schultz, we cease to exist. So we have to find someone to do it who's willing to be the sacrificial lamb. You see, this bill is intended to stop that.
Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Chair. Richard, just curious, on your handout that you gave us, you were discussing how the registered base of 0.5% of the electorate in a district, and there's some testimony just about districts.
Yes, sir.
Versus what looks like the bill states is half of 1% of the total number of electors in the state.
In the state.
So.
Well, the district there is, you can have minor party status in a district without having it statewide. For example, the Socialist Party has ballot status within the 3rd Congressional District, but they don't have it statewide across Oregon.
Okay, but your revision makes it that they have to be statewide. Is that correct?
No, not necessarily. It says, can you show me the number of the lines you're speaking of?
On page 2, line 31 and 32.
Yes, that's right. This relates to the statewide party.
Statewide.
That's right.
And the districts.
The districts would still have to because you can I argue here that if you only have ballot status in one district and you don't have ballot statewide, then you can't really claim that you are a well-established party. You're a party with a foothold trying to become well-established.
Okay, so there's no change then.
No.
In the districts.
No, this relates to the statewide parties. I didn't want to take on too much. People say, don't take on too much on this or else it becomes very, very hard to pass. So I thought I would try to focus this bill on where most of the troubles lie.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Well, we have no one else set to testify on this. Let me just talk to the committee while we're in the hearing phase for a moment. Any of you have any particular heartburn with this? You speak up and let me know.
I kind of like the 1% threshold, but...
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Ripple.
I kind of like them not to run a candidate in a statewide election unless they were real serious, particularly if we get into an election in the future where it's been divided by less than 1%.
Yeah, I understand. Say, what I want to do, I'm not going to work session this today. I want to give you just a little bit longer to take a look at this to make sure that you're okay with it. In concept, I like this very much, and so I more than likely will come back to revisit it. So anyway, I'd just like you to be giving it some consideration, and contact me if you've got any major difficulties with it, okay? All right, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 777. Thank you. Now we will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 427. We open the public hearing, and Sharon McKeon, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sharon McKeon, manager of the Oregon State Payroll System from State Controller's Division, Department of Administrative Services. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 427. This bill is proposing a change to add some language to ORS 238015 in order to clarify a conflict that presently exists related to when a state employee becomes a member of PERS. ORS 238015 provides that an employee becomes a member after working 6 full months. But ORS 238200 brings in a conflict when it says that salary shall be considered earned when it is paid, and the date inscribed on the paycheck shall be considered the pay date. The conflict there can be that while you would normally consider an employee's first 6 months to be perhaps January through June, and they would become a member of PERS in July, the second statute that I read to you causes the conflict because if June's pay is paid on the 1st of July and that paycheck is deemed to be PERS subject, then the employee has only had a 5-month waiting period. So there's the conflict. Senate Bill 427 reconciles the contradiction in those two statutes by modifying 238015 to clearly state that employees do not become PERS members until after completing 6 months of service, irrespective of when the salary is considered to have been earned. This legislation is a result of a collaboration between DAS and PERS. It applies to all PERS members, not just state employees. It provides for clarity without altering the application of the waiting period for other employees who pay on different pay schedules. It applies the law evenly across all public employers, and it will not cause any public employee to lose contributions. So I would respectfully urge your passage of Senate Bill 427, and thank you for your time, and I would answer questions if you have them.
Thank you. Do we have questions? I guess we don't. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 427, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 427. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I will offer two separate motions if you want the second one. Move to send SB 427 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. And what is your other motion?
Put it on the consent.
No, very good. Thank you. Appreciate that. All right. Representative Devlin has moved Senate Bill 427 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Any objection? So move. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chairman, move to put Senate Bill 427 on the consent agenda.
Thank you. Representative Devlin has moved that we move Senate Bill 427 to the consent calendar. Do we have any objections to that? So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 427. Committee, before we bail out...
We have to vote?
Huh?
Do we need to vote?
Section.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Did you want to?
We're the rules committee. We can do that.
Well, everybody would do it.
No, not everybody. Committee, as you can see with the events over the last few days, we are going to be a repository of some of the thorny issues this legislature presents here. And so I just want you to know, as we begin to move into those waters, that communication is a good thing. And so feel free to come see me about any particular issue that you have on your mind. I'll do my best to give you as much information as I possibly can about those things. So the door is open. Let's consider the communication two-way. I'll do my best to communicate with you, and if you would do so with me, and we'll try to carry on as best we can with the kind of spirit that we've had in this committee all the way to the very end, if we can. I appreciate that very much. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I know that later in the session we will move to not a 24-hour but a one-hour rule, and I know that there will be instances under which you will have to bring things to the committee with very little notice. For the particular thorny issues that I think that you reference in this particular case, could you give the committee more than 24 hours of notice? That's the request.
Let me say this, that I will certainly do my best.
And while we're at request, Mr. Chair, I'd certainly request no 11:55 p.m.
Hey.
Representative Gardner, the only thing I can tell you, there's nothing I hate worse in life than being up after 10:30.
Fair enough.
You like to get up at 4:30 in the morning.
I do get up early in the morning. That's true. Representative Devlin's a sharp cookie. Okay. Any further?
Mr. Chair, I do think, though, that those kind of issues that might arise that late, we probably don't need Representative Gardner here anyway.
All right.